of respect for everybody's time. This is the eighth meeting of the Power Gen Advisory Panel. And we have an agenda today, if we could advance the slide, where much like last time, we're going to spend the bulk of the time talking about draft recommendations for discussion, and we have three of those teed up. We'll spend a little bit of time on next steps. We'll do a break, and then we'll start a public input session, which is currently scheduled to go from noon to one. And our objectives follow fairly straightforwardly from the agenda activities. We're going to discuss the draft recommendations, the subset we have set up for today, align on next steps, and then switch over to our dedicated hour for capturing public comments. We have a webinar going recorded. The webinar is being recorded in order to make sure that we accurately capture any public comments as well as panelist comments. So let's move to the next slide, please. Sort of the procedure for public input, I'll probably repeat this towards the end when we start the public input session, but for those of you who are here today, to provide your verbal comment during the session, please enter your name in the Q&A feature. The speaker list is first come, first served. One modification this time around. If you are a speaker who has already spoken at a prior session, if you could hold back just a little bit to give other folks who have not yet spoken a chance. But then, of course, enter your name and participate in the conversation. We definitely want your input, even if it's building on something or comments you're already making. And of course, you may enter written comments into the chat feature, and the comments and or questions will then be aggregated and provided to panel members to be included in the deliberations. And the most substantive response we're going to make to the comments and questions and reactions we get is going to be the extent to which we incorporate them into the emerging recommendations. Next slide, please. And next slide. So today we're going to talk about three initiatives: workforce development, access and affordability for all, and growth of large-scale renewable energy generation. What we're going to do for each is much like we did last time. We're going to go through the small number of slides for each initiative, but then there's one which is going to be the central one that sort of lays out most cogently the thinking on the recommendation, and that's going to be the one we leave up for the duration of the discussion by the panelist members. So let's get into the workforce one. And next slide, please. And again, as per last meeting, I won't read these out loud, but I'll give us all enough time to reread and refresh ourselves. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Can we go back one slide to slide seven? and leave this up for the duration of the discussion. So this is where we throw open a floor to our panelists to comment or raise questions or react. And I will be monitoring the raised hands panel window to call on folks. Lori.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for having us today and giving us the opportunity to speak. You know, I think this is one of the more important components of the state's overall strategy, and you know, I commend the staff for prioritizing this issue and coming up with the variety of components that we have listed here. I want to add that the emphasis on MWBEs is incredibly important, and also stress the need to accelerate the approval process for MWBEs. As I understand it, based on conversations with such businesses, the state approval process can take anywhere from 2 to 3 years, and in some cases longer. Given the opportunity presented by the near-term investments, I think that is something that should be addressed expeditiously. Further, I want to add, on the workforce development component, I think it would be beneficial to have a long-term tracking component incorporated. And I see the beginnings of that in the penultimate item regarding the curriculum through state-funded education, K through 12 and beyond. I think it's important to understand many of the workforce development programs that currently exist focus on getting that first job. But after that, there's not much tracking support, guidance. And given that this is not a short-term issue, this is a long-term need, I think it'll be vitally important to integrate some sort of long-term tracking and support into whatever workforce development programs are initiated, not just to help businesses keep the pace, but the individuals these businesses employ, have them develop themselves throughout their careers and hopefully retain in the clean energy industry throughout. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone want to also comment or build on Rory's thoughts? I think the order is Kit, then Jim, and that's what we're going to go with. Kit, then Jim, please.
Yes, thank you. And I do want to echo and build on Rory's comments. I think workforce development is crucial for the CLCPA transition. And we know that the transition to clean energy will create job opportunities. But as the slides, I think, correctly capture, we need to make sure both that disadvantaged communities are lifted up in this process of the new zero carbon economy and clean energy transition, and that workers at existing fossil plants can make that transition also. So I think there's a dual goal here, and I think the slides and present that quite well.
Great, thank you very much. Jim.
Good morning. I just wanted to, I agree with the Kit and
Can we just lost
Rory.
I'm afraid.
Pardon?
You're better now. We just had an audio loss for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
All right, I'll keep it quick. I agree with Kit and Rory. I just wanted to reaffirm that with the, you know, the opportunities for the people in the industries that are going to be displaced, that we be sure to start some sort of survey as to how many of that workforce will be transitioning, because a good amount might decide to retire, and then that gives other opportunities to others that are not yet in the business, we'll call it. So I just don't want to take for granted that that's what's meant by this. I just feel that if we do a survey of the current workforce, it would be helpful to know where we stand with needing to transition people.
Great. And Jim, for transparency, do I have it correct that you are making exactly or have already made exactly that same suggestion in the Just Transition Working Group?
I have, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself.
No, I was going the other way. I wanted to thank you for raising this with this panel as well as the Just mm-hmm. Transition Working Group. It's a good suggestion, and I think it deserves to be, to get visibility or a hearing in both panels. I just wanted folks to understand that it was properly also being proposed in the Just Transition Working Group. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Bill, you're the next hand, and I see no others after Bill. Bill Acker.
Thank you. I agree with the previous comments. This is a very important area. And I'd like to focus specifically on the second bullet here, second suggestion here around making sure that the focus is broader than just the installation and deployment of clean energy technology, but also includes manufacturing and the entire supply chain. I think New York State has a great opportunity to create economic benefit for our people with growing out that entire supply chain. And we've made some really good progress in offshore wind and in energy storage. And as we look at this, what we need for workforce development is likely a little different for the manufacturing and the supply chain than it is for the deployment side and the operations side. And so my suggestion is that we have a portion of this recommendation that digs a little deeper into requesting that the state focus for the supply chain part looks at how they can engage with the rest of the economic development arms of the state to make sure those industries grow and that workforce is deployed and really finds the jobs that could be available by growing out that supply chain here in the state. So I'd just like to raise the kind of higher profile of those two pieces because we really could capitalize on the clean energy revolution here in New York State.
Great. Thank you very much. Then I have Betta and Jim. I don't know if your hand is a new hand or an old hand, but in any case, let's go to Betta now.
Thanks. Well, I just want to also echo what everyone said, that this is such a critical component of all of this. And I think, you know, this slide and our recommendations here did a great job. Staff did a great job of capturing our previous discussions. We've certainly talked about all of this at length in the equity subgroup in particular, and there's some, you know, really important recommendations here that I, you know, hope are pursued. One thing I did just want to flag is that when we are scaling up job training and programs in disadvantaged communities, which I think is our mandate to do, I think we also want to make sure that there are wraparound services like transportation and childcare and, you know, sort of a resilience support that is really necessary, working with priority populations, including, you know, veterans, which I know is a priority population as well. So just wanted to mention that. And also with the one-stop shop, which is, you know, an idea that I'm so excited about and was lucky enough to be part of the co-design process with a number of different nonprofits in NYSERDA. And that's this kind of concept of this one-stop shop hub where folks from LMI communities can really access a lot of these different programs, including job opportunities. And I think, you know, in addition to having the various state agency coordination and then the CBOs, which are hopefully going to be, you know, really at the center of it. Also local government and county government, because I know where I live in Ulster County, our county executive, Pat Ryan, is doing, you know, a fantastic job to prioritize green jobs and working locally with other nonprofits, with our local SUNY Ulster. And so I think that type of coordination is really what we want to see if we're going to be successful. So it's, you know, it's the state agencies, federal programs, local government, local nonprofits and community-based organizations that serve low-income communities, and also, you know, potentially state elected officials as well. So really kind of approaching this in a holistic way and making sure that we do the necessary PR to promote these programs, because it's great if they exist, but if people don't know about them, you know, they're difficult to access. And I know I've talked to a lot of people who teach at community colleges and BOCES programs. They teach clean energy and technologies, and they say they need students, you know, desperately. And so that's a real shame when we're at this exciting moment with this big transition happening and they need to fill seats. So just some additional thoughts. But, you know, again, I think this slide does a great job of capturing the conversations that we've had thus far.
Thank you very much. And Lisa Dix is the next hand and the only hand I see.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. I just had a couple of thoughts, and I wanted to thank everybody for their comments. I think they're really excellent. I know that the Just Transition Working Group is doing some of this work, and so I'm sorry if it's repetitive, but I just wanted to try to uplift some of that and bring it into this discussion. I really love Jim's idea about a survey. And, you know, one of the things that I think is super important, and, you know, hearing from, you know, our partners and our friends in the labor movement, it's really important that clean energy jobs are family supporting jobs, and that, you know, that we find ways to pair, you know, strong labor standards in all of our policies, as we have done through the large scale renewable portfolio, in terms of requiring prevailing wage for workers, and then with offshore wind project labor agreements. I don't see like strong labor standards as like a goal here, but I think that family supporting jobs in the clean energy industry should always be you know, a top priority. The transition, I have a comment about the transition. One of the things that, you know, when coal was phasing out of New York, one of the things that we learned is that there's really short time in terms when a plant, a fossil fuel plant, coal plant in this case, was going to go offline, and there was like a 90-day period. And one of the constant areas of feedback was that that period was not long enough in terms of really providing a transition for both the communities involved and the workers. So just something to flag and to think about of having more of a longer transition, like phase out plan, where there is that more longer term certainty, so that we can make sure that we're setting up, you know, we have the retraining programs, we've got other programs like early retirement and other kinds you know, glide paths like in place, so that it's not just like a 90 day and then, you know, we're just in this situation where, you know, there's a scramble. So I just wanted to kind of elevate that. And I also think in terms, here there's not a lot of talk about funding mechanisms. And I'm just curious, I know that, you know, the state, and thanks to the PSC for the order last week or 2 weeks ago on the fossil fuel cessation fund, it's really important to have some kind of, you know, pot of funding that is really coordinated across, you know, the community glide path and the worker glide path. And my proposal would be to consider some sort of like state entity. I don't know if it would be NYSERDA or, you know, another state entity that would really, that this transition, like worker and community transition, would be placed where there's like dedicated funding for these programs that are really lined up with, you know, the survey information that Jim is advocating for, so that there is that the certainty of funding that's there to make sure that this is a success and that workers and communities are not left behind in the transition. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. And so I see Jen Schneider, and then I'm not sure if Bill and Beta are old hands or new hands, but let's go to Jen.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I do think this slide does a nice job at putting together everything we've talked about so far. I do want to echo Lisa's comments about labor standards. I think that's something sometimes we kind of tend to take for granted and assume that, you know, when we're creating a new industry of jobs that that the labor standards are already going to be part of it. And we just want to, you know, make sure that that's included for sure. Also, I just wanted to point out, you know, Kit had let us know last week actually in an email that there is a New York State Fossil Fuel Plant Closure Fund, which I was completely unaware of. And I think that's something that if the Just Transition team hasn't already been looking at, I would love to know more about that and, you know, how it has helped in the past and how we can help expand that.
Okay, so I'm supposed to just MC things and not really intervene, but why don't, on this one, Jen, let's say we're going to get you that information. How's that?
That sounds perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Great. And I didn't mean to cut you off. Do you have more to? Thank you. So, Bill, it looks like you have your hand is up.
Yes. Thanks, John. I wanted to actually pick up on something Beta said about the training programs desirous of having students. And I think it was a very, very important point because in our work in the energy storage space, we've talked to a lot of community colleges about starting programs to train workforce for energy storage. And just a reminder, the governor has a goal of 30,000 jobs in energy storage by 2030 for the state. And there are big opportunities here, and it's not just energy storage. Big opportunities offshore wind, big opportunities in a number of areas. One of the challenges here is this coordination of the programs with the industry coming into the state to make this to make the jobs happen, and we don't yet have enough coordination in that area. And so you know, in our conversations with community colleges, we frequently are having the conversation of, you know, we're very excited about starting a program once we have those jobs here. So we have a chicken and the egg situation, because then we have a conversation with the industry and they say, well, we're interested in putting this supply chain component here in New York State, but we need workforce. So we have this little bit of chicken and egg that we need to overcome. And I don't have a great solution to that, but I do believe that picking now up on Lisa's point about potentially more coordinated efforts in the state, that there might be an opportunity here to better coordinate NYSERDA's efforts with Empire State Development's efforts in our growth of those of those jobs in the state with the workforce training of those jobs, and at the very least to coordinate with those job training programs with the various companies that are going to be the employers in those areas. So my suggestion would be that we strengthen some of these suggestions for the manufacturing and tire supply chain, particularly to have more coordination with those companies and also with Empire State Development, and potentially look at different vehicles by which we overcome this chicken and egg challenge that we have.
Thank you, Bill. Jen, your hand is up. Is that a new hand or an old hand?
Sorry, Legacy.
Legacy, okay, great. That's good too. I see no more hands. I'll go to another 15 seconds and then if I see none, then I'll propose we move on to the next initiative. Okay, great. Can we advance then to the first slide for initiative number 6, which may be 2 slides along? Next. There we go. Great. Again, I'll leave these up for 3 slides long enough, one by one, for us to read, and then we'll probably come back to slide 10 for the discussion. Okay, next slide, please. Great, and the next slide, please. Great, let's go back to slide 10. And let me throw open the floor to raised hands. On this one, access and affordability. Laurie.
Good morning, thank you. So the equity subgroup spent a lot of time talking about affordability and access, and we kind of do feel that it's a multi-pronged approach that needs to happen. There has to be monitoring of how people are doing, particularly low income and disadvantaged communities, with the transition. At the same time, we need to study how we can kind of limit or control costs through things like energy efficiency, and really then kind of have like a toolbox approach where we're watching how things are going, and if costs are getting really high for low income and vulnerable populations, that we have a system in place that can help them. There are some really great programs in New York already. The Office of Temporary Disability Assistance has some financial assistance programs for low income customers that can help them pay their energy bills. But, you know, there's also really great energy efficiency programs. So if there's a way to create a stronger communication between all of these different agencies, be it Office of Temporary Disability and Assistance, NYSERDA, Department of Health even, it will really help bring all these resources together and make sure that when people need the help, that everything, all the different options are there. So you can almost create like a layered approach for them. So a lot of information is in the slides, but we're really proud of what we've, you know, been able to put together for the panel.
contributions from the panelists? Kit?
I agree with Lori. I think there's a lot of really, really important recommendations here, and these are crucial. One thought, if you could go to the slide before this one for a moment. And I think I've made this comment before, but in terms of ease of implementation and the fiscal unknown costs that must be accounted for, you know, I certainly understand the need to track costs and estimate them as needed. I do think when we identify costs, we should also strive to identify avoided costs. And certainly there are many here in terms of helping folks in disadvantaged communities, you know, low-income New Yorkers have access to energy. It's vitally important, and you know, we're of course seeing that right now in the impacts of not having energy in Texas. And so I think whenever we refer to costs, we should also refer to avoided costs and benefits and attempt to quantify them.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other hands to be raised? Beta.
Well, yeah, agree with everything that's been said, and really appreciate, in particular, Lori's hard work at pulling together some of our recommendations and crystallizing our thoughts and providing some great input on these recommendations. I was just thinking, you know, it would be great if we could emphasize even more the important role of energy efficiency. You know, Kit was just talking about elevating the issue of avoided costs. And so I'm just proposing that, you know, I would be happy to take a first crack at some, you know, sort of independent recommendations about the important role of energy efficiency and demand response, but especially in energy efficiency and especially downstate. You know, when we talk about avoided costs for grid upgrades and all of that, and also the important, you know, social justice mandate that we have. So, yeah, so I would be happy to work on that if other folks on the panel, you know, think that that's a good idea. But I mean, it certainly like connects to this. Because with more energy efficiency and weatherization, people's bills are reduced, but it also has, there's a lot of other important co-benefits, and it also will help, you know, mitigate the winter peak and the upgrades, potentially. But I think we, you know, we need to know more, and we need, you know, a really comprehensive study, on that, which I haven't seen yet. And then the other thought, which I'm not sure if we've talked about it in depth or at all, or how much the energy efficiency and housing panel has, I imagine they have, but given that the new energy efficiency New York mandate is, you know, a very big, what is it, 185 million BTU reduction by 2025, I mean, that is right around the corner. And so, like, where are we at with that? And is there some kind of, you know, way that we could get, you know, have interim goals connected to the
electricity, you know, demand, the load demand that is projected, you know, for 2030, and really kind of look at that modeling. And perhaps that's already in the works with the scoping plan, and it's been mentioned and I just missed it, but it just seems like, you know, if we're going to do the kind of comprehensive planning we know we need and really ramp up energy efficiency measures, we also need to know how on track we are with those goals. And I could imagine with, you know, COVID this past year, the setbacks that we've had, understandably, we're going to have to ramp up those investments even more. And make sure that we are, you know, especially reaching disadvantaged communities. So just some thoughts and I guess a proposal. I'd love to hear, you know, people's thoughts.
Great. Thank you very much. Bill Acker, you have your hand up, and then I see no other hands after that.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on Betta's comments, and I'm not really sure how well this fits directly into the Power Gen Group's mission, but I thought her comments were very interesting, and I wanted to further the idea that, you know, as we think about how much energy efficiency and demand response and the ability to control the grid edge matters, it's going to matter much, much more as we go forward, and particularly the control of the grid edge, meaning that it's demand response in a smart way. Because, you know, as we're moving forward here, it's always good to reduce electricity consumption, but when we reduce electricity consumption becomes even much more important as we move to a high renewable grid. So if you have baseload power, if you can cut everything by 10% all hours of the day, that's great. If you have wind turbines and solar power making your energy, you know, if you can cut during the times when you don't have much energy, that's even much, much more valuable. So the idea of figuring out, can this smart energy control be done in a way that's inexpensive and goes with the energy efficiency and can be deployed in residences, not just in mansions, right? So I think there's a very good and very important area that falls a little bit between our group and kind of the building's view of the world that warrants some discussion. And I support Betta's point of looking at that. And again, I'm not sure it belongs here fully, but I support Betta's point of looking at it. And I would encourage us to look at it, both from energy efficiency and flexible load reduction at the edge of the grid.
Yeah, so Bill, I'm just going to suggest that we don't worry overly much where something belongs. You know, my own mantra and all of this work is we're allowed to do what makes sense, and if it makes sense to make some recommendations and just to ensure that they're being made somewhere, I think that's fair game. Emily Nelson, and then I see no other hands after Emily.
Hi, I just wanted to respond to Betta's point about studies on what the future grid demand would be. Some work has been done in this way, in this area, from the NYISO as well as some of the state studies. The work presented by E3 to the council covered some of their estimates. Some of the trends that we're seeing is that shift from summer to winter peaking occurs later in the 2030s. And the estimates vary, and they will inevitably change through time. I certainly support the recommendation that they need to continually be refined. And I think that's a theme across many of the topics we've considered, the need for continued study, refining of the estimates. Some of the work completed thus far shows that peak usage could increase by a couple thousand megawatts. The energy demand will increase more than that, of course, depending on adoption rates across the vehicle sector as well as the building sector. One additional point adding on to what Bill shared is I think there's several components on the demand side that are important for us to consider in addition to refining our studies. Energy efficiency has a big part in making sure we reduce that overall peak load. And then I'd like to echo the point that building out flexibility in the demand through demand response programs, distributed energy resource programs is also a really important part that allows us to really deploy that response when it's needed on the grid and sort of fine tune that response on a more granular basis. So I think both sides are needed in this end state that we're working toward. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Any other comments on this access and affordability for all initiative or actions?
One other thought that I had was,
go Beta.
You know, and Lori probably is much more of an expert at this than I am, but, you know, how do we ensure that the people who are eligible for these programs are actually participating in them and, you know, really encouraging that or mandating that the utilities make more of an effort you know, on that front? And, you know, and who are the customers that, you know, are eligible, and, you know, what kind of challenges are they facing? You know, do they desperately need, you know, better insulation? You know, is that an issue? Are they on expensive, you know, fuel sources, you know, delivered fuel? You know, what are some, I think if we had more information, more, you know, kind of granular detail about customers and how, you know, then we would hopefully be able to provide better support services. And I mean, especially now with, you know, the crisis that we're in and so many people, not being able to pay their bills, you know, it just seems like, and perhaps there already is a big effort underway to kind of tackle this, but it seems like a lot more needs to be done, you know, by the utilities and of course, you know, by the state.
So, Lori, there was a bit of an invitation to you there by Beta.
Sure, and just raised hand too. No problem. So there is, you know, some of that happening right now. DPS, you know, has been overseeing the moratorium on service terminations, and our organization has been working really hard with groups across the state, be it other legal services, tenants' rights groups, foreclosure prevention programs. I mean, a lot of it is going to come down to coordination and communication and making sure that everyone's kind of doing their part, because people go to different entities when they need help. And so having the utilities doing bill inserts and communication to, you know, not only already identified low income, but let's be honest, we have a whole new population of low income. I mean, the data as far as how many people are falling behind on arrears, you know, and what the total amount is, it's over $1 billion right now as of December for across the state when it comes to energy. And that's not even including LIPA. So we have a serious financial situation right now that's going to follow people forever. But people may not go to the Office of Temporary Disability Assistance or their utility. They might go to their church, or they might go to a nonprofit in the area. So that's where, again, in one of the slides, we have, you know, support for groups like nonprofits that are very local that will have these resources. And, you know, hopefully if we can create some sort of system like OTDA has mybenefits.ny.gov, where you can go and apply for food stamps and you can go and apply for the home energy assistance program. If there's a way to take something like that and tie it in with weatherization and energy efficiency, so that when you apply, you know, you have to have internet and a computer, but again, for all hopefully working together, if you apply through something like that, it can kind of identify, okay, great, you're at 60% median income, you qualify for this. Did you know about Empower through NYSERDA? And so hopefully some sort of coordinated effort will help with a lot of that easing, because we do have programs now, and they can always be improved, but we have a base, but now it's like connecting all of these groups together and hopefully having the support to make it work properly. So hopeful that we can do this and, you know, really continue to help people, because now's the time. Like, now more than ever, we have to do this work.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions or other reactions? I'll leave the floor open for 10 seconds.
Yeah, hey guys, this is Stephen Rowntree. I will gobble up that 10 seconds. Just as it pertains to...
You have more than 10 seconds.
Take
all the time you need.
Thank you. And I apologize, I was a bit late to the call, but just as it pertains to sort of the renewable side here, I mean, I think like really focusing on... you know, directing state efforts and NYSERDA to sort of affirmatively targeting disadvantaged communities for renewables projects that generate income and reduce energy bills for residents, I think should be an important part of this plan. So just making sure that, you know, just beyond availability of programs, you know, grants, technical assistance, things like that, the state actually take some of its own stock in making sure that organized constituencies in those areas are reached out to, and sort of the full availability of DER's projects are sort of put on folks' plate in the way that's easiest to get things done. And I think, you know, we're looking at the scale these projects need to take place at. I mean, I think it's something that we should keep in mind. For sizing projects or sizing programs up is, you know, obviously looking at the social justice mandates of the law and really focusing on that. I mean, I think if we're looking for, you know, like how can we get low income households to come to the, drink the water, so to speak, and when there's already such barriers to getting those projects, getting, you know, homes retrofitted and getting projects done. I think it's really important that the state take a really affirmative role, a proactive role in making sure that the resources meet the folks that need them. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Okay, with that, let's move on to the next initiative number 7. If we could advance, I think, the slides one more. Great. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Can we go back to slide 13? And let's leave that up while we have our discussion. I'll throw the floor open. Of course, if we need to call up any of the other slides to help the discussion, we should feel free to do that. So let's please use the raise hand function. Kit.
Well, of course, this initiative is absolutely crucial, from all perspectives. The CLCPA mandates that we get 70% of our electricity from renewable resources by 2030, of course, and 100% carbon free by 2040. So this is really at the heart of the matter. And of course, New York State has some great programs in place to make to support large scale renewables, offshore wind, land based wind and solar, and there's been great progress. But I think, and I think these recommendations are all pushing in the right direction. But I think we should have specific goals to make sure that we're on track. So making these recommendations more pointed and specific. So, for the first one here, there remains a large amount of renewables that must be procured and developed. I think DPS and NYSERDA have this information or can easily develop it. You know, how much new renewables do we need to be adding to the system every year to get to 2030? It may not be completely linear, but what's the track that we need to be on? And are we on that track? If we're not, what do we do about that? Are there changes to the NYSERDA RFP process that need to happen? Do the RFPs need to be more regular? So I think we need to get a little bit more granular and specific in these really important recommendations. I also think the second box here about increasing renewables penetration in the downstate region is really, really important. There's a lot of interesting thinking and innovation going on in this space, including the Renewables Rikers project, and the City Council just passed legislation around that last week. So again, sort of digging in a little bit more into, I think we should be digging into what needs to be done in New York City and on Long Island specifically to increase renewables penetration, as well as getting transmission right. One thing I really like about these recommendations, the way they're presented on the slide, is the cross references to the other work groups. I think it will be really important to get the community benefits piece right, to get the community siting piece right, as we work to build greater acceptance for large-scale renewables in host communities.
Great. So Emily and then Corinne.
Sorry, took me a moment to get to my mute button there. Just a quick comment on the third component on the slide with respect to the need for new and upgraded transmission and distribution systems. I'm happy that the power grid study is referenced in there. Obviously, there's quite a bit of good work and set of recommendations included in that study. I would like to call out that an additional element that is referenced in the power grid study is the opportunity for public policy, which is something that's within the NYISO's tariff. And I do think we may want to expand the key stakeholders to also include the NYISO. To the extent that public policy effort continues to be an important part of supporting transmission build out. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. I have Corinne, then Lisa, and then Bill. At least that's the order I'm choosing to see. So, Corinne?
Sure. I just wanted to sort of add on to what Kit mentioned regarding the first two items here, that we could certainly add more detail. The most recent 2020 CES order, as precipitated by the CES white paper, outlined annual targets for all of the procurements, which include Tier 1, as well as offshore wind, and also imposes a non-binding target on Tier 4. And so we could certainly build out more detail here to show the trajectory as to where we need to be to hit our 70 by 30 goals. So we can certainly build that out more, and I'll support the team here to include that detail. That's all for me, John. Just wanted to add that.
Great. Thank you very much. So Lisa, then Bill.
Hi there, and thank you, Corinne. I think that would be super helpful. I just, in box one, I just really wanted to give a shout out to the governor and to the legislature for really busting a move and getting the Accelerated Renewables Act passed last session. I think that establishing the Office of Renewable Energy Siting is a huge step forward, and I'm really eager to see how that office is able to really begin to break down some of the barriers that have existed for renewable energy siting, large-scale renewable energy siting. And I really see like right now that there's a lot of really great efforts underway. And some of the projects that were in Article 10 are like now moving into that process. So time will tell, but I see it as a really, really important and vital step that the state took to really dig in and lean in and really hit the CLCPA goals. On the second box, some of the thoughts, really thinking about, you know, I feel like some of the conversations that we've had are like, look, we've got a state framework, because we do, that's going to get us to 70%, right? And I feel like some of the conversations are a little, are in my mind, and maybe it's just because I'm not, you know, a transmission expert per se, or, you know, a expert in, you know, all kinds of ways in which utilities, you know, can like move projects forward to get online. But the one thing that occurs to me is that, you know, Kit alluded to this in her comment, that we really have to bust a move on ensuring that we are hitting the targets, especially downstate, right? And especially because that is where a lion's share of the fossil fuel plants that exist in the state's fossil fuel, you know, anyway, the state, in all of our fossil fuel plants in the state is what I'm trying to set out. One of the things that to consider is that I don't think we can make the assumption that just because we are in the state building, you know, the lion's share of the renewable energy down or upstate, that that is going to translate to emissions decrease of our fossil fuel fleet. And just throwing it out there, I think that one consideration could be some sort of kind of hard target on emissions reductions in the state, and an assessment perhaps like every 3 years starting next year, where, you know, we are really taking a hard look to ensure that we have the right programs and policies prioritized that are really ensuring that the dirty is coming off and out of the system as we're scaling up on clean. And I think that really setting an emissions target or something like that, very similar to what Corinne just flagged for us, that we do have with renewable energy, we have targets. We have, you know, how many million megawatt hours we're going to need to hit that 70%, right? And then the solicitations and the RFPs are really tied to that trajectory. But I think we actually need to do the same thing on the emissions side to ensure that we are
prioritizing the right policies, and we are laser focused on making sure that those emissions are coming off because our policies are actually working and targeting a real drawdown of emissions over time. A three-year assessment, I'm throwing it out there, it helps us be able to calibrate. So if we are able to set an emission decrease target, then we're able to say in 3 years from now, okay, what do we actually have to scale? What do we have to dig into? And what are the policy priorities and funding and investment priorities we need to be making to make sure that we stay on this trajectory to get to a 70% by 2030 and then 100% by 2040. And I'm worried that just having the view that, you know, building a whole bunch of large-scale renewables upstate, and we're going to do it, we're going to succeed, we're going to also succeed with offshore wind. But I think that there are a lot of policies that we've talked about ad nauseum, like storage demand response, different kind of contracting mechanisms, and local transmission that are going to be essential to making sure that we are taking the fossils out as we're, you know, scaling these programs and really investing in the programs that are needed in the new grid that we're going to need to achieve our goals. And then my final point is the third bucket. One of the things that I do see missing from the power grid study is local transmission analysis or requirements. So I'm not necessarily, I was a little concerned about if we get like 15 gigawatts of storage, that's what that study basically said, you know, we're still going to need, you know, a whole lot of dispatchable fossil fuels, according to that study, to be able to really, you know, make this work. And one of the things, you know, and I want to just like caution, you know, and just say that if I don't know if that study was done with, you know, not having any changes or not making any changes or the changes that we need to do, like if everything just stayed the same, that's the change, or that's the conclusion. But what I do think is that maybe it is worth thinking about a public policy solution with really figuring out, you know, what modeling NYISO can do, or the utilities or the local transmission owners, with really looking at fossil fuels being phased out, you know, by 2030 at 70%, and really digging into what are those local transmission solutions that are needed both on Long Island, New York City, and the rest of the grid, to really get out ahead and to figure out prioritizing and working with the utilities and the local transmission owners to make that happen, because transmission we know is going to be a critical solution to decarbonization. And I'm not quite clear that the local transmission solutions are getting the kind of attention that, say, like this bulk transmission analysis is getting. And so it's a question and a comment in hopes that we can really kind of lean in and dig into that, because I think that's going to be an absolute critical and necessary component to a complete decarbonization of New York's grid.
Great. Thank you very much. I see Bill, and that's the only hand I see. But Bill, you're up.
Okay. Well, there's a lot here. Let me start by agreeing with and supporting Lisa's points about the idea of having tracking and metrics environmentally and emissions going forward. I think she raised some really good points there. I wanted to comment on expanding on Emily's point on the importance of the third bullet here. And we've frequently used the term energy delivery to broaden the words transmission and distribution. And Lisa touched on this at the end of her piece also of, you know, if we have a lot of storage going on to the grid, it's really important that we actually merge that planning And you know, I love analogies, and I always think about the transmission system a lot like roads. And I know there's limitations to all analogies, but you know, we have our highways, we have our sub roads. We know we have congestion problems, and we have much more congestion problems as we put more renewables on. And what we are talking about is building more roads, which we absolutely have to do. But we also have to think about moving the traffic at different times of day. You know, you can't just keep building the highways and think that you're going to be able to move everything when you just have too much to move at a particular time when we get to very high renewables and we literally have more renewable generation than load in the state. So we need to think about a broadening of that piece. And so to Emily's point about the stakeholders here, I fully agree with her. The ISO should be a stakeholder on that third bullet. I also believe that the renewable developers themselves and the companies that are involved in more innovative solutions on the T&D network, not just transmission developers themselves, which some of them are involved in innovative solutions. I don't want to take away from them, but there are numbers that we should be adding to that. So as we're thinking about this, you know, the importance of holistic studies, and one last point on the power grid study, because it was raised a minute ago. You know, the power grid study, we've talked about this in the subgroups, really only gave two options for how you do flexible assets. They had short duration storage and they had peaker plants. So we should take with a little bit of a grain of salt how much peaker plants need to be left or infinite duration assets in that study. We really do have to do a new study, and I believe that's in our recommendations elsewhere. But I think we need to keep that in mind, that it's important to make sure that we do this holistic view of energy delivery, which I think we're all heading to in our comments and all the subgroup pieces.
Great, thank you, Bill. Anything more on this one? With that, we have powered our way through the recommendations that were developed and that we wanted to tee up for discussion today. Let's go to the next step slide, if we could, just to remind folks of what we have in mind coming up. Next slide, great. So in terms of things that are looming or impending, we have a Climate Action Council meeting coming up this Friday at 3 p.m. Among the topics that will be discussed, and I believe the topic that will be most directly relevant to our panel is the subject of electrification, where the electrifying panels, transportation and energy efficient housing, as well as our own panel, will have a bit of a discussion. We have another panel meeting on March 10th in the afternoon. We're at this point pitching it as, discussing the remaining subset of draft recommendations. And again, as we are going to do today and as we did last time, also soliciting public input. So with that, we now have a bit of time, which we can do it as we please. We have the public input scheduled to begin at noon. In the spirit of not upending timing indications that we've given to our public watchers and commenters, I don't want to I don't think it's right for us to switch around that timing too much, but we might, I think last time we started quite successfully a little bit early at 11:45 for the public input, and which means that we probably have about 45 minutes or so before we would need to resume to do that. Do folks have any suggestions or any discussions that they want to invest that next 45 minutes in? You know, this would be a raise the hands kind of question. You know, I know that there's a lot on our minds, but you know, and maybe we want to use that, the time we have that we're gathered for the, for some of that work, or maybe we really want to not do that because it doesn't make sense for one reason or another. So if folks have proposals on how to use the next 45 minutes until 11:30 or so, after which we take a break and then reconvene at 11:45, that's my proposal, please speak up, or just speak up on the idea of taking a break between 10:30, 11:30, and reconvening at 11:45. So let's go with John Reese and then Beta.
Sure. Given the number of hours a week we're putting into subgroups, I'd love to have 45 minutes to an hour off to do other work and take a break.
Beta?
I'm happy to also have another little bit of time here in the day, but I just did want some clarity on our meeting schedule, because as John just said, there are so many meetings, so little time. So we're meeting on March 10th at 1 o'clock, and that will presumably be another, like, what, 3.5 hours? Pardon, on March 10th is like our next meeting, full meeting, right?
Right.
Then are there any other meetings of our group that I should know about? I know we're having our cross-panel collaboration meeting with the transportation panel on Thursday. Is there anything else that we should have on our calendars? Is the March 10th meeting like our last meeting?
It's probably not the last meeting. It is, I believe, the last meeting that we've, it's the furthest out that we've scheduled. So I'm going to suggest that the staff folks, by which we all mean Sarah and Benjamin and Macy, will be getting in touch with us to figure out whether we need to look beyond that, and if so, what that actually means. But as you noted, there are other working group meetings that are happening in the interim. So that's a to-do. I think it's best to leave as a to-do for the staff team to kind of survey the appetite and the availability of folks for after March 10th.
Okay. And then I guess just a follow-up, what do we have left? I know that we haven't necessarily dug into the community benefits conversation maybe as in-depth as we would like, or, you know, distributed DER. I don't know if there are other things that we are saving for that March 10th meeting that we should just have on our radar to, you know.
Can we, again, in the spirit of sort of just basing that on good staff work, can the team send out a reminder that this is kind of this is the menu as it stands, and it'll probably be 90% right, and we'll have a chance to get it, you know, 100% right, and then work it and react and the like. So is that okay? I think that's probably the most productive way to
answer great.
Your very, very reasonable point.
Thank you.
So I'm going to propose that John Reese has put a motion on the table, and we're going to go with silence is consent. So if folks want to do something other than take back 45 minutes or whatever it is now, 43 minutes. They need to speak up, otherwise that's what we're going to do. I'm sorry, and then it'll actually be more like an hour, and we'll reconvene at, why don't we reconvene at 11:40 in that case, to give ourselves 5 minutes to get organized, and then public inputs can begin, public input comments, et cetera, can begin at 11:45. So that's the motion on the table. Raise hands if you want to propose an alternative, but otherwise we're going with that. All right, the motion is carried. Thank you, and see you in just under an hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, thanks, guys.